Hey, good morning. It's Thursday. That means it is time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for being at the other end of the radio waves, the telephone lines, the Twitter machine, and the email communication device of your choice. So many ways to connect nowadays, and you're invited to avail yourself of any or all of those devices. Old-fashioned phone, of course, 414-1234. If it's local, 800-926-8809. If long distance, twixt you and us, Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email, and our Twitter handle is at WFSU Perspective. You know, there I was looking this morning online, which is such a great research tool, of course, and there are actually some ancient images of people removing honey from wild bee colonies that go back somewhere around like 15,000 years. And the cultivation of more domesticated bees probably began sometime around 4,500 years ago, as best we can kind of determine. So people and honeybees have a really, really long history together. So we kind of do this now on an annualized basis. I think we started this, four or five, maybe 6 years ago, of bringing in some people who are involved with the local beekeeping or apiculture, I think, is the term that's used now, a community to talk about beekeeping, both in a rural and even a more urbanized setting, as so many of these hives are right now. And we got a whole – we have an entire hive all lined up here and ready to go. So we're going to go around the table, meet some members of the Appalachian Beekeepers, and find out a little bit about the current status of bees, which, as we said on our promo that we were using all this week, they're kind of that old canary in the coal mine when it comes to so much of the threats to the ecology that may be lurking out there. And it kind of hits them hardest and first. And we can take a hint from them as to what may be coming down the road to us. So, Bob, let's start with you. Your full name, sir?
Good morning. I'm Bob Steele. I'm president of the Appalachian Beekeepers Association.
Yeah, it is wonderful to see you, Bob, and we'll find out your involvement here and get the full overview of Florida beekeeping here in just a minute, okay?
Okay.
Okay, right next door to you, you have Alan.
Alan Stroud, and I've been a beekeeper for about 30 years, but the differences between today and those years 30 years ago are quite different.
I can't imagine there's been any change over 30 years. We'll have to get more into that here in a minute, huh?
Thank you.
Okay. Bob.
And I'm Bob Livingston. I'm a master beekeeper through the University of Florida Master Beekeeper Program, and I'm the treasurer of both the Appalachian and the Florida State Beekeepers Association.
Okay, so these folks have to be really, really nice to you because you control the purse strings,
right? That's right. I'm the Count de Monet, as they say.
Okay, and who's this disreputable character right next door to you here?
Rick Flagg, occasional dabbling in beekeeping and radio, doing that. I'm basically here for comic relief. So if things get bad, I will warn you, I'll drop out some really bad jokes.
Yeah. Wasn't comic relief something that HBO started as a fundraiser years ago for unworthy causes or something?
And here we are again.
Urban beekeeper in Florida, News Network Capital Bureau Chief Rick Flagg, by the way, and partner in crime, lo these many years on the radio ways. Right next door to you, Michelle?
Michelle Val, and I am a local beekeeper. I have been doing it for about 5 years.
Wow. Okay. I want to get your perspective on that. Now, Mr. Futch, welcome to these microphones.
Good morning. Charles Futch. My wife, Susan, and I have been beekeepers for about 8 years. We're members of Appalachian Beekeepers. I've been on the board of directors and a past president. We enjoy beekeeping, and we run somewhere between 3 and 12 to 14 hives, just depending on time of year and how lucky we are.
Out there by the Greenway, you are.
Right.
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, let's start, if we could, with you, Bob Steele, here. A good question of where are we in Florida? Because we hear the horror stories from elsewhere around the country that colonies are collapsing and there's disease and pestilence and all that thing. How are we doing here?
Florida's the third leading state for honey production and the second leading state for the number of colonies of bees. Beekeeping has changed dramatically over the last 25 years. It used to be all you had to do was go out and collect the honey just about, but there's some pretty bad pathogens that have come into the country from Asia about 25 years ago called Varroa destructa and small hive beetle that really can wreak havoc. And where that becomes important to the average person is that you're really dependent on feral bees or hobby beekeepers to do your pollinating. And if because these pests that have come in here are affecting all bees, and including the feral wild bees, they're decreasing in number. As hobby beekeepers, we treat them. We don't have a good treatment, but we treat and manage and replace hives that get lost. So we need more hobby beekeepers. The important message is that anybody who has a house and a yard can be a beekeeper in the state of Florida. You don't have to have 40 acres and a mule. If you've got a yard at all, you can have a honeybee hive, and it'll produce more honey than you need, and it'll pollinate your garden and your neighbor's garden. That's the real message that we're trying to get out there.
Okay, and I think that there are a lot of folks that aren't aware of the fact that without the pollination services provided by honeybees, the health of the many of the plants that we know and love and even just take for granted would be in serious jeopardy. I mean, that's what keeps the whole thing going.
That's true. Without pollinators, and honeybees are some of the better ones, you won't have fruits. You won't have a lot of the vegetables that we depend on.
Okay. Alan Stroud, you were talking about how you got involved in that. Talk about your hive and what you got set up now.
Okay. Currently, I have one hive. I did have two up until about 3 weeks ago. The second one was weakened. I think probably just the queen wasn't producing what she should have been doing, and consequently, they were robbed. Bees do that. They're opportunistic, and the hive just eventually went through a demise. I got started about 30 years ago. I had a friend that was going to the Peace Corps, had a hive. He didn't know much about it. I didn't know much about it. My grandpa had raised bees years ago. I was interested in doing it, so I took his hive and I put it out on some friend's property in Jefferson County, and it stayed there for 10 years, and all I did was go out once a year and harvest the honey, and that hive lasted that long. From that point on, I had difficulties with the hive. I would go through a period where it would not collapse, but it would come close to that. Didn't harvest anything once in a while, and then I would lose the hive. And I've probably gone through about seven or eight changes ordering bees or getting a nuke. A nuke, one of the other folks here can explain about. I ended up with two hives just recently. And it's good to have two hives versus the one because you can compare the two and see how they're each performing against the other.
Okay. Well, Bob Livingston, if for folks like Alan there who may be having some challenges with their hives, number one, you have some resources in the Beekeepers Association and University of Florida and IFAS and all those guys. I mean, they can bring some help to the table. But what about folks who say, my gosh, that sounds like an awful lot of trouble?
Well, it is a lot of work, but it's you get that sweet reward when you produce the honey. And honeybees are just a fascinating insect. They're the only insect that produce food for human consumption. And back on the pollination thing, about a third of the food we eat is insect pollinated, and honeybees are by far the majority of the insect pollinators. So if honeybees and those pollinators went away, about a third of the food we eat would either be really hard to get and really expensive, or it would just go away.
You know, it just seems so counterintuitive because so many people think, oh, bees, they sting, they're nasty, you know, we must move away from them rather than approach them. And Rick Flagg, I know it was a real shock, I think, for a lot of us in the Capitol Press Corps when you got involved with that. It was like, how did this happen?
I blame Paul Davis, actually, my old partner at Gulf 104 back in the Rock days. And he just asked me out to his farm to help him out with some work on one weekend, and it turned out to be bees. But and from there on, I was hooked. It's just – they're fascinating creatures. It's fun to work with them. It's nice to have a hobby that actually produces an end result. I mean, how many of us spend our weekends doing things that have absolutely no payoff at all? But this way, you get the honey. And frankly, I'm putting more emphasis on the bees now. I was too worried about honey over the past couple of years. I need to spend more time learning my bees, figuring out what they're up to, and let the honey take care of itself.
Okay. And Michelle Bing, you've got a hive too. 5 years in the
yes.
biz now. Any regrets?
Oh, not at all. No. It's a fascinating, like Rick said, it's fascinating. And I started out initially with a lecture on backyard beekeeping that two of our members from the Beekeeping Association gave at New Leaf Market some years ago. And I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. So I went, and they were also signing up people that evening for our short course, which we'll talk about And I signed up and I took it, and I became at that point totally committed. And I started out in my backyard with the two hives, which expand to four and to six. And now I have my hives at an organic farm just outside of Tallahassee, and they thrive unbelievably. And it's in addition to being fascinating and a nice hobby with a sweet reward, I find it almost meditative. In other words, when you go to your hives, you forget about everything else, and you're only focused on the bees and the environment and their amazing behavior, and you forget about everything else. And so for me, it's a very relaxing, even though it's a lot of work sometimes, but relaxing and meditative.
Yeah, it sounds almost like a Zen exercise.
It can be. It can be.
Yeah. And Charles Fudge, talk about your experience with
Actually, I grew up just a very short distance from here. My father was the manager of the Florida State University Dairy, and he had two beehives, which were probably about 200 yards from where we sit right now. And I was never really very interested in it because I was a free-range kid, and I had already been stung by every insect known to man in science, and I just didn't see the need in signing up for more of it. But 8 years ago, my wife was somewhere and saw an open hive demonstration and signed us up for the short course. And we really had no idea that we were going to do it, but we decided to try it. And as Michelle says, it's really a contemplative and Zen type experience. You have to be in the zone, so to speak, or otherwise you'll make terrible mistakes, which
and they will
I'm
make
sure
you
all
pay.
Of it. Nobody else has done it but me.
Well, we'll have a short course on how to get started in this whole thing when it comes to backyard beekeeping in just a moment here on Perspectives. And, of course, we want to hear from you at 414-1234, long distance 800-926-8809, or if more convenient for you to drop an email to us. Here's the address, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back on Perspectives, talking bees and beekeeping. 414-1234, 800-926-8809. Before we go to the phones, President of the Appalachia Beekeepers, Bob Steele, how do you get started on all this? You're just listening to this program, or you happen to stumble across a website and say, boy, that sounds kind of neat, but I have no clue how to get started.
Two or three ways, but the you got to do it at this time of year. You can't decide you're going to do it at Christmas and start beekeeping. You got to do it in the spring when there's a good honey flow. The nice thing is, and what I tell people is, if you take our short course, which we're offering March the 12th, second Saturday in March at the Wakulla Extension Office, if you take our course, you're automatically a member of the club. And if you come to the meetings that we have monthly, which is geared to new beekeepers, I virtually guarantee you that you can be a successful beekeeper. We teach and have open hive, and then at our monthly meetings we have what we call open hive, where we open a hive so that an experienced beekeeper is there for people who want to get a little more hands-on help with what's going on in the hive. And you can become a beekeeper with no experience before.
Okay, and some people may say, oh, gosh, that sounds like, you know, a huge investment. You got to build a hive. You got to get the bees. You got to get all the – I imagine there's
it's
protective
cheaper than
gear.
Golf or fishing.
Oh, really?
And you get honey.
Okay, that's coming up again, March 12th, the Wakulla Extension. That's right next to Hudson Park, isn't it?
Yes, in Crawfordville.
That's what I thought. Yeah, down in Crawfordville. Here's an email just came in from John. He's wondering if any – folks around the table here are familiar with the documentary Julie's Gold, a documentary on beekeeping.
You mean Julie's Gold?
Julie's Gold. Yeah, I was going to say yes. I thought it was Julie's rather than Julie's there. Yeah.
I think everyone in North Florida has seen that. Yeah.
I was going to say it was shot here, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and in Orlando as well.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And with apologies to Jeff Foxworthy, if you saw Julie's Gold and didn't think there was enough footage of the bees, you might be a beekeeper.
Bee porn. Uh-huh. Okay.
But you laugh, but there is such a thing. Don't. Just
keep I'm not even going to go there, Rick, for crying out loud. But this whole area has been known traditionally as a major source of very specific types of honey, such, of course, Tupelo, which is
– vastly overrated, yes.
Yeah, but that comes from the Tupelo plant, which is what, in the Apalachicola River Basin, right?
It's a tree, and it grows primarily in the Apalachicola River Basin and the Ogeechee River up in Georgia. And that's the only place – the Apalachicola River Basin is the only place that Tupelo honey is produced. And it's a renowned best honey in the world. It the sugar content of it is such that it won't crystallize like most other honeys, and it's just a real premium good product. Unfortunately, Tupelo blooms around April 15th, and for the last I don't know how many years, it seems to always rain and be cloudy and cool during that period. So the Tupelo harvest has been steadily going down, and last year there was virtually no Tupelo produced in Florida. Wewahatchico is sort of the capital of Tupelo honey production, and it's been a really bad year. We haven't had a good Tupelo year probably in the last 5 or 6 years.
Wow. Here in Tallahassee, though, neighboring counties like Gadsden, Jefferson, and all that, what kind of plants do the bees usually, or can you even categorize that? You know, if it's not Tupelo trees, then what do they seem to pull from here? Just everything in sight? Or?
Well, most of us have to label our honey as wildflower because we don't honestly know where it's all coming from. You know, they're working whatever happens to be in the neighborhood. But I know some people do – what's the berries?
Gallberries.
Gallberries, that's a big specialty item. But, you know, to get one specific brand of honey, you have to get all your honey from that right. bloom. Right. Which is what Tupelo is about, which is what the gallberry about. But for most of us who just leave them out there, it's wildflower.
It's wildflower. You don't have a clue. But there are very specific flavor differentiations when it comes to different areas because that's where the bees are working and they're getting their pollen from those areas.
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, to call a honey, a varietal honey, for instance, Tupelo, they examine the honey, the pollen content in the honey, and it has to be at least 51% Tupelo for you to call it Tupelo. So the same thing for gallberry or saw palmetto or whatever. It has to have at least 51% of the pollen has to be from that floral source.
Wow. And like Rick said, I mean, how can you tell? You can't ask the bees. You know, where'd you go today?
Well, in order to make a varietal honey, you need to take your bees down to the honey, to that crop, or, you know, a real good source of that plant just before it starts to bloom. You take all the honey off the hive, you know, so they don't mix it with what was already on the hive. And then as soon as the bloom is over, you take that honey off and process it so they don't mix it with whatever blooms after the target crop. And that's how you get a more pure honey.
Okay. Is there anyone ever get any pushback from neighbors, particularly those who live in more urbanized areas, that, you know, oh, you got all them bees over there, and my kids are going to get stung?
Well, if the bees tend to go to swimming pools sometimes as their water source, but if you give your neighbors – a couple of jars of honey a year, it does not seem to be that big of a problem.
A little bit of bribery works okay, right,
yes.
Charles?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And also it's not a legal problem because Florida has a law that says you have the right to keep bees in your backyard, and cities and counties, well, they've basically been preempted by the Department of Agriculture. So yeah, if the city calls up and says we have a problem with your bees, you just say, well, I'm sorry, take it up with the Department of Agriculture. You have no authority over this.
Okay. Well, and speaking of Florida statute changes and all that, we were talking right off the air a few minutes ago about the fact that now you can obtain locally produced honey in most food retail outlets in this town, which we never saw before. What happened to change that?
Well, not in the food retail outlets. You can get it at farmers markets and things like that. And what happened is they passed the cottage food law and included honey as one of the cottage foods. And in that way, you can bottle in your home kitchen. You can sell at farmers markets any kind of a one-to-one exchange. In other words, I could sell to you I couldn't give it to Rick to sell to you, or I couldn't put it in a retail store. So it has to be direct from the producer to the customer. And you can't sell more than $15,000 a year. Otherwise, you get bumped up into the commercial class.
Mm, okay. Has anyone here at the table gotten close to that threshold?
Or we don't, we spent about that much money, actually.
To produce, what, 50 bucks worth of honey? Okay. Yeah.
Right. There is an old saying that you can make a small fortune in honey as long as you start with a large one.
And Tom, on Saturdays at Downtown Marketplace, there are several vendors that are artists as well as just vendors for honey products. So, again, it's wildflower, as we were talking about earlier, sometimes some tupelo honey and gallberry honey also.
Okay. Back to the protective thing, though, because we see all the time beekeepers portrayed as wearing the hats with the netting and all this. Is that necessary? Is that part of the deal? Or?
Yep.
Well, some people work without it, but most of us prefer to wear a veil, at least. That keeps the bees from stinging you in the face. They have very good carbon dioxide receptors. And if you think about a bear attacking the hive, where is the hair the thinnest on a bear? The face. So the bees follow that carbon dioxide trail up to the face. And when a honeybee stings you, his stinger pulls out and the bee dies. But it also marks you with a pheromone that tells the rest of the bees to sting you in the same place. So think of it, if you can sting a bear in the face and you can mash your stings, that's going to have a much more detrimental effect on the bear messing with the hive than if they stung him all over his body.
Okay, so just a word to the wise there, protection is a good thing to have.
Yeah, bees communicate by smell, and so your smoker is your most important tool, because what we use the smoke for is to jam the bee's sense of smell so they can't smell the alarm pheromone and this, that, and the other. So,
it calms them down?
Yes, it calms them down. They tend to go in the hive and gorge themselves on honey, thinking they may have to leave home. And they don't want to leave home on an empty stomach. So the smoker is the most important thing. Now, we're just trying to jam the bee's sense of smell. We're not trying to create a smoke screen so they can't see us.
What's the deal with royal jelly? We see that now being touted as some kind of a miracle product for rejuvenating skin and fighting aging and all that kind of thing. Any?
It works great if you're a bee.
Yeah, that's marketing.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it does for human beings.
Yeah, I'm seeing all kinds of commercial advertising and promotion for that stuff right now. Is it being hailed as some kind of a miracle product or something?
Well, simply a protein-rich substance that the nurse bees manufacture in their hypopharyngeal glands to feed the developing larvae.
And if anyone wants to know the etymology of all of this stuff, Charles Futch is the guy that you need to talk to on that. But that's where that comes from then. Okay. Dan's intrigued by our conversation here. Let's get him in on the deal as well on line one. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you. My wife insists that I buy organic honey. And I'd like to understand how honey becomes organic. I mean, Can you elaborate on that, please?
Organic? Has anyone ever produced inorganic honey? Or
it's almost impossible to produce organic honey because the bees go at least a mile in all directions, and so you can't control what they get on or get exposed to. So that's more marketing than it is reality. Bees just go where they want to go, and so you can't promise that it's organic.
Yeah, that's not the key word to look for when you're buying. Look for raw or unfiltered. That's basically it, because organic is it's like Bob says, it's nonsense. You can't tell where your bees have been. Yeah. You can't make that claim, and the government has said that quite specifically.
People don't understand that every extraction of honey that we do, virtually everyone tastes different and is a different honey. What you buy in the store is just not like what we produce, because they blend it and filter it and sometimes heat it, trying to keep it from crystallizing. All we do to our honey is run it through a strainer and it goes into the jar. There's no processing done to it, so it's organic in that sense of the word, but organic as far as there not being anything done to the bees, you can't control where the bee goes and what the bee gets.
Yeah, by definition, they are free range. You can't have domesticated bees in a controlled environment specifically to pollinate these kinds of plants or whatever.
I think the X-Files was the only one that pulled that off.
The honey is out there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Robert joins us online, too. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hello. I manned a booth one time for the Florida Wildlife Corridor, and I was right next to an Apalachee beekeeper's booth talking. I was talking about a piece of property that we had out here that we thought would be a very appropriate place to put some beehives, although we're all too busy to do it ourselves. Is it possible to offer the land to members of the association and that they might, you know, want to maybe put some hives out here? And do they have some evaluation process or something like that? What would be the process to go through if he wanted to try to do that?
Oh, okay. We'll throw that out then, Robert. Appreciate that. Bob Steele, what do you think?
The best solution is for you to become a beekeeper and put your own bees out there. Most of us are hobby beekeepers and don't have enough hives that to spare a hive, if you will. We want to pollinate our own yards and our own gardens, and most of us don't have an excessive number of hives to be putting anywhere else. I have people calling wanting that, and we don't have any – we generally don't have any takers. We had one club member a couple of years ago that lived in an apartment, and she took advantage of that situation, but that's about the only situation. You know, we have people approach us all the time saying, I've got a fruit tree in my yard. Would you bring your hive over here? And it's more trouble than it's worth for us because we got enough to pollinate where we are.
Yeah, but Robert brings up a good point. How much like with any hobby, you can go absolutely overboard with this stuff and spend hours and hours and hours every single week on it. What's kind of the minimum you can get away with if, you know, I'm working two jobs, I got all these other obligations, but I still want to get involved in beekeeping. What's the minimum that you can invest as far as time is concerned?
Well, you got to have two hives, and when you first start, it's probably a good idea to do hive inspections pretty frequently, maybe even once a week, just to get some idea of what is going on inside the hive and compare the two hives to each other and try to assess the health. And as you become more familiar with the bees, it takes less time to do it. Right now, we can look at a hive very quickly. Make a reasonable assessment in five to 10 minutes or so. If it looks like there are problems, it would take longer. But that's how we do it.
Yeah, but what kind of problems do you see? Like Alan was saying, you had some setbacks with the one hive there and,
right,
you know, just about lost it altogether, and it took a while to build that back up. So if there is trouble, though, you've got to make an investment of time and resources and all that, right, to turn it around, right?
Yeah, in my case, I think my queen fell ill and then just didn't produce anymore. So I had no eggs, no larvae for the nurse bees to take care of. So the hive was frustrated. Robber bees came in, recognized the declining health of the hive, and just finished it off. So as they've indicated, you need to really inspect the hives pretty frequently. But after that, I say I probably go in maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks and for either one of the two hives if they're both healthy.
Mm-hmm. And then just go in at harvest time and, you know, get
– That's right.
Get the produce and go.
Manage for the diseases and other things that might show up.
But to follow up on something Alan said, anybody can have bees, be a bee haver. They can buy a hive of bees, set it up, put it in the backyard, and just leave it alone. What we're all about is becoming a beekeeper, and that's somebody that's going to go in the hive, inspect it on a regular basis, try to spot problems, and do something for the problems. For instance, Alan's queen, if it died at a certain time of year, he could have gotten a new queen, or there's a way to go in the other hive and take a frame of eggs and put in that hive and have them raise their own queen. But in order to be – you need to be proactive in order to do that. And so you'll be in your bees more during the spring of the year because that's swarm season and when you're trying to get them to build up, and less during the fall and winter of the year. You're really checking their food supply to make sure they don't starve to death.
Okay. Are there commercial suppliers for this?
Yes.
I need a queen. You know, yes. How much is a queen going for nowadays?
$25.
About $25.
Really?
You can order queens and you can actually order bees through the mail. They'll come in a shipping package and they're shipped overnight. And you actually get a little 3-pound cage of bees called a package of bees, and it's a 3-pound screen box of bees with a queen and some feed. The postman generally comes to your house first that day, or you pick it up at the terminal.
But it's good to be nice to them, too. They appreciate a jar of honey as well.
Right. And we do handle the package so carefully. Did you notice that?
Yes. But, yes, there are bee producers, people in the, or members of the Appalachian Beekeepers Association produce nucleus hives, which is a way to start a new hive. It's basically a small hive of bees that you use to start a bigger hive. Most of us don't do packaged bees, which are the bees in the box.
Oh, I was going to say, honey, our box of bees has just arrived here.
Well, you have enough hives, and you go through and you shake bees through a shaker thing into the box and put a queen in it, put a lid on it, and you can either pick it up. Rossmann's up in Moultrie sells a lot of packaged bees. They're probably the closest to us for packaged bees.
Wow, that is fascinating. More calls and emails on the way here as we continue our discussion of bees and beekeeping here on Perspectives with members of the Appalachian Beekeepers Association, 414-1234, the local number, 800-926-8809, long distance and perspectives at WFSU.org, the email address. Right back. Don't even use the that old saw, what's the buzz here, as we talk about bees and beekeeping and all that. No cheap puns allowed here at this table today on Perspectives. And before we go to the phones and the emails here, Bob Steele, you were saying as far as the actual investment of time and all that, this just beekeeping does not have to be unrelenting toil on the part of the beekeeper, right?
Correct. It's not time-specific demanding like a dog or a cat or a horse or anything like that. You go work the bees when it's convenient for you, just about always.
Okay. Tigger Gray checks in here on Perspectives. My gosh, I haven't seen him since the last ESPN shoot. Hey, Tigger, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you all?
Could not be doing better if we tried, man. Thanks for calling.
I would just like to thank Dr. Rick Flagg for helping us out, and I believe he became a doctor when our allergist sent us to him in order to get local honey to help our son Harrison, who has near-on asthma, but it basically kicks in when he gets all the pollen and, the usual spring and fall pollen falling, which, of course, has just started to do again. And he says, you get the local honey, you can build up a resistance to it. So we've really appreciated Dr. Rick Flagg helping our son out.
And I appreciate you buying my honey, Tigger.
Yeah, he's Tigger. I see him right here with his diploma. He's polishing that up here, which will be mounted down at the Florida Press Association.
And right,
I'm sure,
now, every serious doctor is thinking he must die.
Now, that has been something, though. Tigger brings up a good point, and that has been said anecdotally now for a long, long, long time, that the small bits of allergen in the pollen, if ingested in honey, can reduce the susceptibility.
Sort of like a vaccination.
Exactly,
Now, we have a real doctor here, Bob, who knows that there have never been any studies that actually prove this. It's all anecdotal, but so many people believe in this. There's got to be something to it.
Yeah, and it would seem to make – I mean, this is the way the polio vaccine and everything was developed. But still, there are no studies that
He's
say conclusively that this is for real. But still – We need sweet stuff anyway, and if you're going to go sweet, you might as well go local honey, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And if frankly, if it works on your kids, I'd do it. You know, who cares if there aren't any studies? If it makes your child less miserable with allergies, there you go.
Let's see. Yeah, did you want to jump in there?
Oh,
yeah.
I was just agreeing with Rick. And Also adults. I mean, I also sell at a local market, farmer's market, on Saturday mornings. And I have adults come and say they want the honey for their allergies. And they'll even be as specific as to ask me where exactly are my hives located, because there are other vendors of honey at the Timberline farmer's market. And if they can pinpoint where my hives are compared to where they live, then they're interested in buying it because they insist it helps their allergies. So it is anecdotal, but they say it helps.
Okay. Paul sent us an email, wants to know, how do keepers keep Tupelo honeybees from contaminating the Tupelo honey with other flowers from the surrounding area? That gets back to what we were talking about before. You can't tell the bees where to go or what to pollinate, right? They're kind of...
That's correct. You try to take them to a really primo source of Tupelo blooms, and you hope that Tupelo is all they're going to get into. But again, you can't control where they fly. If they find something they like better, they'll go to that.
But Bob does what they do there is they take out an empty hive. The honey super, where they say it, is empty. They start out with that, and then you pull the hive out of there as soon as the bloom is done. So theoretically, whatever you have in the super at that point is all Tupelo.
Yeah. Okay, and it has to be, as you were saying, Bob, a certain percentage before you can call it Tupelo honey.
Yeah, any varietal honey, correct.
Okay. Sally joins the conversation here online, too. Hi, Sally. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Listen, this is just a comment, but your beekeepers probably know it. I don't know if your listening audience knows, and I teach this in class, that in the English countries, when the lord of the manor dies, the first group that has to be informed is you must tell the bees on the land that the lord has died. And it is a very complex ritual that involves going out to the hives and telling them what has happened. And I talk about it in class, but it's really a very interesting historical ritual that takes place still in certainly in Scotland and Wales and England, and I'm not sure about Ireland. But the telling of the bees after the death of the lord of the manor is a very important part of owning large tracts of land.
That is a fascinating story. And that's one, obviously, you didn't get from Gerald, right?
Nope, he didn't tell me that.
Yeah, okay. Bob Steele, what do you think? He was nodding his head there, Sally. Let's see.
Well, there's a – have you ever heard of eking out a living? That came from beekeeping. The old skeps that used to be the old type of hives, the king – honey was the only source of sweetener for a large part of history. And the king demanded a large share of the honey. So the farmer would put another section, which was called an eke, on his hive to make sure he had some for himself. And that was called eking out a living. And that's something that's still used today, but it came from a long time ago, the same sort of thing that Sally's talking about.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it sounds like the angel's share if you're making whiskey or something. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah. We had talked a little bit about with the bee stings and being drawn to the face of the bears and all that. Maria sent us an email, wanted to talk about the possibility of beekeeping drawing other wildlife, specifically bears or other things that you might not want hanging around. Charles Futch, have you had a lot of bears out on your property?
No, we don't have any bears. But if you are going to keep bees in an area where bears are located, you're going to need an electric fence. And even with that, it won't be a guarantee that they'll keep them out. They will bend over saplings to short out the electric fence and climb on in. They'll even run through it if they have to. But we don't have any bears. We're in sort of suburban area, and I've never seen one.
Okay, but I know that there are other types of wildlife that might be attracted there. And now in Carabel, we're even getting monkeys, from what I understand.
Really?
Yeah, that was someone posted a Facebook picture of a monkey eating on something on his patio down around Carabel just the other day. So there's a small colony, apparently, of macaques or something.
I'm going to take your word for that.
Yeah.
Bears are the biggest problem to a beehive. I mean, raccoons are not big enough to get in the hive. Skunks will eat the bees. They scratch on the front of the hives, and the bees come out, and they eat them, chew them up, and spit them out. But, I mean, they're not going to kill a a whole hive is a general deal. Now, you will have problems with two-legged predators from time to time. Some people will go in, and actually a lot of people are having their hives stolen. Mm-hmm. That's becoming more and more common.
Really?
We have hives out in a remote area, and they're worth $250, $300, $400 a piece, and people go out and help themselves.
And that's irrespective of the honey production that comes out of there.
That's correct. So you lose the bees and the honey production.
Oh, wow. Back to the phones we go. Karen's on line one. Hi, Karen. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi there.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. When looking for local honey for allergies, what is a bee's range? I mean, as opposed to how far away they need to be from where I live.
Like the roaming radius of a hive or a colony?
Generally, they're about 3 miles from a hive.
About 3 miles?
Is the average, yes.
Okay. That's good to know, because it's like, how do I know I'm getting honey that's indigenous to where, close to where I live?
Well, that's great. Well, another thing I want to mention on people that sell honey, the Cottage Food Act doesn't mandate that beekeepers can only sell honey. So anybody can come to a beekeeper, buy honey in bulk, put their label on it and sell honey. So when you're buying honey at a local market, question the beekeeper, ask them how many hives they have, how long they've been in the business, this, that, and the other, and try to buy from somebody that is actually a beekeeper and not somebody that's just out there selling.
Okay, that's it. Very good. Thank you. Right.
Appreciate the call, Karen. Thanks so much. And we still have about 10 minutes left in our perspectives as we talk about bees and beekeeping this morning with members of the Appalachian Beekeepers Association. 414-1234, 800-926-8809, and perspectives at WFSU.org. Oh, it was probably about, 30 years ago, 30 years plus, the great fear of the African bee invasion was just all literally a buzz across the country.
Right. The killer bees.
The killer bees are coming.
Yeah,
but what happened?
Oh, they're still out there. Yeah. Fortunately for us, they've stopped at I-4 corridor. They're below the I-4 corridor and not up here. You can't tell an African bee from a European honey bee, that Italian bee or a Carnolian bee or anything else, by looking at them. You have to do either genetics or you can do microscopic wing evaluation to look at the veins in the wing to tell if it's an African bee. But the only difference is that African bees are more defensive. If you disturb them, half the hive or more is coming out after you, and they don't stop 20 feet from the hive like our bees do. They'll chase you for 100 yards. And they swarm a lot more frequently, and they make smaller hives that can be anywhere, in a utility box, just almost anywhere, that makes them – it's you disturbing them that's dangerous. They're not any – and the sting from a bee is the same venom as a rattlesnake puts out. It's just a matter of the volume. A lot of people say they're allergic to bees. They're really not allergic to bees. They get – a normal response to a bee sting. You're supposed to swell and get red if you get stung by a bee. It's just the volume. If you get stung 5 times, it stings 5 times. But if you get stung 1,000 times, that can be a lethal dose.
Okay.
From any bee.
I bet just a matter of degree then.
Not. Right.
And also where they get you. If they get you right in the face, one of them got me right by the eye duct here, all of a sudden that whole side of my face, and it just took 6 hours to see the whole poison move across your face. So if they get you in one of the sensitive areas, it can really be a pain.
The University of Florida is doing a lot of work with Africanized bees, and they have a website. If you just do a search on honeybees, University of Florida, you can drill down to their website and find a lot of information there.
Okay, and speaking of information, let's get a plug in too for the – you have regular meetings as well as the event that's coming up next month, correct?
The second Tuesday of every month, we meet now at FAMU Viticulture Center on Highway 90 close to I-10. We're having our short course the second Saturday in March. And if you want to be a beekeeper, that's the way to do it. That's the way – we have over 200 members of the club, and virtually all of us got into it, into beekeeping, by taking the short course and becoming beekeepers.
Okay. And Bob Livingston, of course, the big thing coming up Saturday, March 12th, down at the center in Crawfordville.
That's
right?
Correct. And also the Extension Office, Panhandle Extension Offices, County Extension Offices are having a bee course that is going to be March 7th, 14th, and 21st. And if you contact your local county extension agent, you can register for that. University of Florida Master Beekeeper Program is March 3rd, which is a good way to learn about bees. It leads to a Master Beekeeper or a Master Craftsman certification, and that's a real good program. And then at University of Florida's Bee College is March 4th and 5th, and that's a real intensive weekend all about bees. There's a beginner track and a more advanced track, and Dr. Jamie Ellis and his folks do really excellent work. He's the head bee guy in the state of Florida, so much so that we're trying to get funding to build a new bee lab for Dr. Ellis and his crew that will hopefully provide some research and help us resolve some of the problems with the bees. And if you go out to the Florida State Beekeepers website, you can find out how you can donate to be a part of that.
Yeah, I was checking that out this morning. They had a lot of good resources on that site.
Yes. Yeah, and we do want to say thank you to members of the legislature. For 2 years in a row, they have put money in the budget for that bee lab. Now, it didn't end up in the budget because of a certain veto or two, but the legislature really does support that bee lab,
yes.
And we appreciate that. They understand what's going on. They understand the importance, and they understand that Florida should be the national leader in bee research because we are the perfect climate. We have the experts here. All we need are the facilities.
Okay, let's check in with Donna here on line one. Hi, Donna. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hey. Bee behavior is so fascinating. I hope that humans and societies in general can take their lead from learning how to organize themselves better from bees and ants. But I have a comment and a question and a concern. With the Zika virus, I'm so afraid that our hysterical response to that might be using way too much pesticides. And I wonder if your experts there have a concern and a comment about that as well.
Well, we've had several other incidents, for instance, after some of the tropical storms, they want to spray to keep the mosquito population down. And usually if the spraying is done at night, it doesn't affect the bees because the bees are back inside the hive. And that's not saying if the truck runs, you know, right in front of the hive, you're not going to have a bee kill. But they spray usually with a chemical. They usually spray at night, and the chemicals they use rapidly deteriorate in daylight. So, you know, that's... You know, pretty much by the time the sun comes up and all, they're pretty much gone. So it depends on how they spray, what they spray, but there will certainly be an impact on beekeepers. Hopefully we can keep that to a minimum.
But usually if you do contact the county to let them know where you have hives, they will avoid that area. I mean, you just have to let them know you're out there.
Yeah, well, that's the regular spraying, but when they spray after a tropical storm, it's usually an aerial spraying, and you know, there really is no such thing as a – you know, do not spray list.
Yeah, and we're not to the point where pesticides are DNA specific so that they target just the bad bugs and leave the good ones alone.
And they have a mosquito minnow that they can put out that eats the mosquito larva. And there's also a biological control that gives them they spray on the water or put in the water. I think it's a pellet. And it gives the mosquito larva like dysentery and kills them. So there are more natural controls, but I think the cost-effective thing to spray on a large area, something like for Zika virus or if you're trying to spray for encephalitis, it's going to be an aerial spray with an insecticide.
Okay. Or you can have a bat house. That works pretty good, too. So. And they don't eat bees, I don't think, do they?
Mosquitoes.
Bats eat mosquitoes rather than bees.
So. If the bees are out at night or late, they probably so. But generally, there again, the bees are usually back in the hive during the night, and the bats are active during the night.
Okay. Just a few minutes remaining in this morning's program on Perspectives, going into the wonderful world of bees and beekeeping with members of the Appalachian Beekeepers. And let's get some final comments here from around the table. Charles Futch, you brought – let's talk about your thing. Well, I don't want to leave your chart alone here before we dismiss.
I have a chart here from a study conducted by Cornell University, and it deals with the food plants that are pollinated. At least 90%, of them are pollinated by honeybees, and the total value of these crops is annual basis about $10.5 billion. That's with a B, and pardon the expression. 90% of that would be $9.5 billion that wouldn't be there if it were not for honeybees.
Like to eat? Thank a bee. Mm-hmm. Michelle Beck.
Yes, I'd just like to emphasize the fact that our local beekeeping association is an incredible resource. And for a new beekeeper or for somebody who's contemplating keeping bees, we have just an amazing amount of knowledgeable, experienced beekeepers and enthusiastic new beekeepers, and it's an incredible resource.
Gosh, and we're within the one-minute thing. I want to say goodbye to you, Rick, and thank you for doing this here.
Absolutely. And don't forget the short course, best way to find out for sure whether you want to be a beekeeper. After one day, you will know.
You will know. Bob Steele.
Yeah, that's right. Come see us on March 12th. We'd love to have you.
Okay. Alan Strout.
And I echo their sentiments, the course and the club.
I hear the echo. And, of course, Bob Livingston, Bob Steele, thank you so much for coming in. And
thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls doing the technical stuff back behind the glass. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Streets, hotels, even an entire Florida county bear the name of the guy who was territorial Florida's first governor, William Duvall. On next week's Perspectives, we'll talk with the guy who literally wrote the book on this guy and how his influence can still be felt in the state today. Coming up next week right here in Perspectives. See you then.
Available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.